the faith in people's ability to survive makes them profound models for what we need right now. I think we're going to see a resurgence of Gwendolyn and her life as a model, along with Lorraine, the way we're seeing now with James Baldwin.
And with all of these vicious murders of our precious young Black brothers and sisters,
yeah.
People go home and just read the quatrain, the last quatrain, Emmett Till, by the great Gwendolyn Brooks.
Yes, that,
8 lines, 4 sentences. We are witnessing America as a failed social experiment.
How do we tell this story in a way that builds the kind of emotional momentum that colorblind ideology built?
So many young brothers and sisters of the younger generation find themselves so far removed from the best of their past.
What are we going to make out of the nothing we've been given? How do you envision possibility?
Hello, everyone. How we doing out there? We are so happy to see you. Welcome, and thank you for joining us on The Tightrope. Here, we try to engage in a serious and interesting and sometimes funny dialogue, but we try to keep it rich, and we try to balance ourselves on tough issues when necessary. I'm Tricia Rose, and I'm here with my dear friend and brilliant colleague, Dr. Cornel West. How we doing, Cornel? How you feeling today?
Oh, I tell you, I'm strong as ever talking to you. I can tell you that.
I know. It's so much energy we have when we get together talking about so many things, right?
Absolutely. It's so true.
We decided to do this episode on two amazing artists, sister artists, Black women artists, mostly known for their work in the 50s for the most part, but not entirely in the 50s, Gwendolyn Brooks and Lorraine Hansberry. These are two Chicago Titans, brilliant artists who had so much to say. So we wanted to just talk about them and talk about all the things that they mean and all of the ways in which they've been misunderstood and the political significance of their brilliant work. So we're just going to talk. It's going to be a freestyle conversation on these Titans. And I'm going to immediately throw it to Cornel for setup because he's the best table setter in the business. And I just want to hear your thoughts on these two amazing women. I mean, I love them both dearly, but I can't wait to hear what you have to say.
I just hope that the audience gets a chance to read your brilliant essay on the one and only Lorraine Hansberry, published in 2014. We're going to get to that, really delving deep into the relation of love and freedom on the one hand, or what you call interpersonal justice, and the struggle for political and economic justice on the other. But I think we want to begin first by acknowledging that the Black literary tradition in the United States is the only tradition whose major inaugurators in terms of the dominant genre have been women. You think of a Phyllis Wheatley in poetry, you think of Harriet Jacobs in the novel, and of course, Toni Morrison being the highest representation of the novel, not just in America, but in 20th century, but also a Black woman. You think of Anne Plato, who's the first writer of essays, a book of essays in the Black literary tradition. You think of Marianne Evans, who was the first person to speak in public to a sexually integrated audience, a male and female. And then, of course, when we get to the music, the Ma Rainey's and the Bessie Smiths, the first great blues singers of whatever gender. And then the greatest vocalist, Sarah Vaughan, Billie Holiday, Ella Fitzgerald, Dinah Washington, Carmen McRae. We got Sam Cooke and Johnny Hartman and Luther Vandross and Donny Hathaway, but even they and all of their genius don't ascend to the level of a Sarah or a Billie or Ella. So there's something about the Black intellectual tradition, there's something about the Black literary tradition that lends itself to the centrality of the genius of Black women. So when we come then to Lorraine Hansberry, who is the greatest playwright in the history of Black folk, and August Wilson sits alongside her, of course, and Gwendolyn Brooks, who's part of the legacy of Phyllis Wheatley, but takes it to a level that Phyllis Wheatley cannot conceive of. Here we get these two exemplars of this great Black literary tradition whose major pillars in terms of being the inaugurators have been women. Now, that's very, very unique and singular in the modern world. I don't think scholars have really appreciated it enough as they ought. Of course, Black woman scholars have, and Black feminist scholars have, but it's rarely talked about. Does that make sense?
Yes. I mean, that was fantastic. I mean, you strung a group of women together, some of whom I hadn't put together in my mind recently. And there is something, I think, about the way that Black women are positioned both as Black and as women that give them a unique understanding about how different categories of recognition, of suffering, of community building are intertwined. And the ways in which a certain kind of presumed heterosexual femininity was denied to Black women also gave them access to a kind of psychological form of leadership in the community that, or they turned that rejection of subordinated femininity into a role of leadership, to put it more clearly, that I think also plays out in the creative realm.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And absolutely. So, yeah, I mean, I think absolutely. The two women that we're just choosing to focus on this episode today are extremely interesting for a few reasons. And we talked a little bit about this the other day casually that kind of turned this episode into the episode it is. And this is the degree to which they were both deeply committed to the Black community as a whole, deeply invested in the artistry and the politics of Black radical freedom. But at the same time, they were both deeply misunderstood and sort of forced into choosing between a certain kind of recognition and fame and the community as a whole. So you talked a little bit about this the other day, and I want to make sure other people get to hear you on this because I think it's extremely important and really relevant to today.
Well, one is that both of them were cast as the darling of the white liberal establishment. That Gwendolyn Brooks herself, a genius flowing from Chicago, even though she's got roots in Kansas of both parents, Keziah Corrine and David, her mother and father. But she wins the Pulitzer Prize in 1950, owing to Annie Allen. She'd already done A Street in Brazzaville in 1945. She immediately receives the Mademoiselle Award. She meets Richard Wright. Richard Wright was, of course, the person who had written the first support of her first book when he was contacted in 1945. She gets a Guggenheim. She's a member of the American Academy of Letters. So that with the Pulitzer, American Academy, the Guggenheim, Mademoiselle, she gets honorary degree from Wake Forest in 65. I mean, she's completely embraced. And for her to then make that shift when she meets giants like Haki Mahibute, Fisk University, and Nika Giovanni at Fisk University, that famous conference of 1967, and comes back and is now revolutionized in terms of her association with the Black arts movement, very much Black nationalist in its sensibility, and the white liberal establishment, they go berserk. So when you look at In the Mecca, 1968, versus The Bean Eaters, 1960, there's deep continuities because she always loved Black people. But it's very clear that there's a militancy, that the revolutionary spirit in the Mecca that she got from the younger artists. Same would be true with Lorraine Hansberry. Mm-hmm. Lorraine Hansberry, the first Black woman to hit Broadway, Alice Childress's Trouble in Mind had already been planned, but didn't work out. Here comes the young Lorraine, another genius from Chicago, hitting Broadway. She actually wins the award against Tennessee Williams, Sweet Bird of Youth, Archibald MacLeish, J.B., Touch of the Poet by Eugene O'Neill. That's who she beat that year as the young Black genius that she was. So that she's then embraced, and they don't realize she's a revolutionary.
That's right.
She's been deeply shaped by W.B. Du Bois at Jefferson School. Mm-hmm. She was a co-editor of the Freedom magazine, founded by Paul Robeson. You know what I mean?
Yep.
So that they don't even realize who they're messing with. She's always been a revolutionary intellectual. And therefore, both in so many ways are not fully grasped. I mean, part of it's just genius. Genius is never fully grasped by anybody. You could be a towering literary critic. Hortense Spiller's great essay on Gwendolyn Brooks, which is always worth reading, gets added. Farrah Griffin would be another one. Bell Hooks been wrestling with it. But, you know, but Brooks and Hansberry, they in a special space, very special space.
So true, so true. Thank you for that, Cornell. I mean, I had no idea who Hansberry beat out in 1959, so that's good to know. That's some heady company. The other thing is so amazing about both of their corpuses is that they're able to capture a kind of everyday people essence of Black lived experience and creative expression and improvisation in living, without being condescending, without looking like they are trying to model something of that they don't know about, right? Or to sort of get down with the people. It feels so organic and so real. And they're able to capture the spirit behind it and the political significance and the emotional significance of everyday culture. And so they share that, I think, very significantly, right? In the way they write and the way they capture and move across areas of life. They're both keen observers, keen observers. That gift, I think, is partly what accounts for a kind of white liberal embrace, right? It feels easy to read them. It feels easy to understand what they're doing, when in fact they're quite difficult to understand. And the way they were misunderstood, it's almost as if you're only talking to the community, right, they'd be perfect voices. But as soon as other people take it up, if they're not well-versed in what the stories are really about and what the political disposition is really about, then it can easily be fed into a mainstream fantasy. That's what happened to Re Real Cool, right? As if it was somehow a critique of 7-year-old boys playing pool and, you know, dying soon, as if it's a dysfunctional Black space, right, that she's narrating, which isn't at all what she was doing. And the same holds true for Hansberry's Raisin in the Sun, which gets understood as a swan song for integration. I still to this day cannot understand how at the end of that play, anybody paying any attention whatsoever, even when P. Diddy's in the doggone thing.
I remember that.
Could they possibly misunderstand that when Mama grabs her plant, that they're supposed to be lucky moving on up? This is supposed to be, you know, a happy, like you're going to go to a place where they're about to pay you to not move in an all-white neighborhood in the 1950s?
God,
I mean,
that's so
how misunderstood, right? How not knowing can you be?
That's true. You know, there's a line in that play you recall as a guy who was the Nigerian brother. The African presence is always very strong in Lorraine Hansberry, because she had a global perspective. We thank Imani Perry's recent book on this that points this out. But there's a crucial line where he said, you know, there's something wrong with the civilization and a situation in which dreams depend on the death. Because remember, it's the death of old man Walter that generates the whole story,
$10,000. That's right.
And it's the death of little Claude. In some ways, that was the catalyst for old man Walter dying. When little Claude died, the little baby that he and mama had together. And so from the very beginning, you're getting a book about death at its deepest level. And then the moment when mama walks in and said, oh, we ain't never been a people, five generations of slaves and sharecroppers who other people told us that we were so less than them that we accepted their definition of reality, and therefore we become the living dead. And Walter's talking about money, money, money. She said, oh, we used to talk about freedom. Now all y'all talk about is money. Oh, so you got another kind of level of death that Lorraine's dealing with in terms of how these folk who have been physically murdered, maimed, killed, still dish out children and cousins and aunts and uncles and friends who are still so much alive, but then now they've gone to the city and lo and behold, their souls are dying. And she already saw this 1959. And then the moment that you accent in your essay about measure him right.
Ooh. Right. Ooh. Yeah, I mean, to me, that's the climax of the whole play. That is the turning point that reveals what she's really trying to deal with, and of course, it's the hardest to love each other when you are on the cusp of giving up all that you need and to survive in your community, right? That moment where the buy-in makes the most sense, why not give up? Why not, in this case, take the money, right? I mean, and of course, you know, are we not dealing with this today, right? I mean, we're dealing with this today, the darlings of the liberal establishment, right? Determining how the conversation on racism should go, what it should look like, what it should say, what it can't say. Are we not dealing with this in terms of Black celebrity and in terms of the music industry and the control over narratives and the effort to make it look like we're not shucking and jiving the way that scene where Walter grovels to pretend like he's just going to be, you know, an old shuffling Uncle Tom, right? Now we have a whole different level of performance that involves the very same calculation. What am I going to get paid to do? I can't change this system. Dignity's not going to get me anywhere is the story. That's what Walter was basically arguing. And, okay, you know, let me just take the money that I can take. And you, on the one hand, you can't really argue with Walter. And that's what's so beautiful about how Hansberry handles it. Because there's no giving up on Walter. There's no outrage. How dare you? It's really, we understand this, right? This is what we've been fighting against, because this is what spiritual death looks like that goes on while you're trying to kill the actual physical body.
That is so, so, so very, very true. You know, James Baldwin, in his essay on Sweet Lorraine, he says the beautiful thing about Lorraine is that she never confused making it with keeping the faith.
Right.
And making it is the young Walter before his transformation, who's obsessed with money, power, status, spectacle. He is very much a product of what we would call today the culture of superficial spectacle. Right. We understand why he wants money, but he's thrown himself so much into money that he's no longer able to keep the faith. By keeping the faith, we're not talking about anything religious, dogmatic, or doctrinaire here. We're simply talking about not selling your soul for a mess of pottage, you see.
Right.
And giving up your integrity, honesty, and decency in order just to have prosperity.
Right. And his vulnerability is also the vulnerability of a deprived, underfunded Black patriarchal masculinity, right?
Ooh,
he wants
true.
To be the head of his household, and white supremacy and its distinctive attack on Black men, because they're the biggest threat in a white supremacist patriarchal universe. And I say universe. intentionally.
That's
you
right.
know, and so his whole desire to make it is to do the best you can do with that longing, with that goal, with that aspiration. And of course, all the women around him don't even want that for him in particular. They believe in the strength that he's bringing, right? Regardless of that. But that's the seduction of the power of these kinds of expectations that society provides to us. So our failings become personal, not situational, not structural, not created by the environment that we're in, but in fact personal. So he takes it all very personally, what he can't do for his son, what he can't afford to do. But there's another thing that happens in Hansberry that when I was writing the essay you referred to, I found a piece by a woman whose last name I think is Lippitt. And what she had copies of the movie version script that Hansberry wrote when the play was going to become a film in Columbia Pictures. And Hansberry went out of her way to try to make more visible the texture of Black suffering that she felt many white fans and critics did not see in the play, right? So they imagined this as a happy ending, right? She thought, let me explain to you how unhappy this ending is. And let me explain to you about the real context. So she wrote in on the movie script all of this texture and detail, close-ups of Black hands, close-ups of African-Americans getting bad fruit and vegetables in their neighborhoods that were more expensive. She really dovetailed really systemic racism and the way it played out in transportation, in service jobs, and so on and so forth, and the degradation really that was required. And the amazing thing was in the margins of the articles and scripts, they basically just X'd it out and said, too much Blackness, unnecessary, Unnecessary. Mm-hmm. Unnecessary. They literally erased Hansberry's effort to put in material to make the argument that they refused to see the first time she made it.
Wow.
And I mean, wow. It was.
That's part of the history of much of Hollywood right there.
Yeah.
Too much black humanity.
Too much. Let it go. Too we don't need
black
it.
Black love. Too much black honor. And one of the things that
we don't care. We don't care.
Both of our towering geniuses always presuppose black humanity, black dignity, black majesty, black diversity, black variety. And so anytime you really talk about black folk, you never talk about a monolithic group. You're right. Talking about distinctive personalities who have been shaped by a whole host of realities, including white supremacy. And she finds the centrality of struggle. What does she call it? She's a sad but sweet indictment of an impatient and inquisitive people. That's what she says in one of her essays on Young, Gifted, and Black. That's
Young, Gifted, Young, Gifted, and Black, right? Published after, yeah.
Absolutely. Mm. But I think back also to Gwendolyn Brooks' great poem, saluting her father, David, that first poem in The Bean Eaters. Mm-hmm. He dies in 1959. And she dedicates that book just like Lorraine dedicates Raising in the Sun to her mama. Mm-hmm. In gratitude for the dream, mama. And that mama on the stage, the American stage, never been more love manifest in the soul of one character than in Mama by Raising in the Sun, given all the history of the American stage. Yep. But the tribute to the father in Gwendolyn Brooks, where she talks about the father as gentle. Mm-hmm. And you see, that's already going to be a certain attempt to shatter the toxic masculinity that so many of us black brothers can easily get seduced into.
That's right. Encouraged to perform.
Exactly. So that there's a courage to be gentle. He was a gentle person. And how does she end it? She talks about, as I recall, there's a public love connected to a private charity that was shot through his heart, mind, and soul. See, that's Gwendolyn talking about black men.
Mm-hmm.
Ooh, boy, that's not a challenge these days. Nothing is a challenge these days, given the centrality.
Right, that's right. You know, this is that question. You know, have we really limited, although on the one hand, this moment is more rich and diverse in terms of presentation of self, sexual identity, gender identity, there's more fluidity and openness than at any other time. And at the same time, there seems to be especially a hardened rigidity around what a heterosexual black masculinity is supposed to be. And that any kind of sweetness and gentleness and consideration and sorrow and sensitivity has somehow been relegated and diminished as feminine, which is a double insult, in a way that makes it difficult for us to really combine those things into a respectable, acceptable form of masculinity, heterosexual masculinity.
And I would say even with the breakthroughs and the pushbacks against the vicious forms of homophobia and transphobia and the expansion of the quantitative forms of relation, that I'm not sure there's been a breakthrough in the qualitative forms of relation. Because you can have the same manipulation, you can have the same self-contempt in, you know,
any orientation,
lesbian relations, trans relations, any orientation. Because when you live in a highly commodified culture, no matter what you're doing with your body and your body parts, if your spirit is not rich and deep and expansive, you still would just be reproducing a lot of the narrow forms of titillation that have nothing to do with high qualitative relation in connection with one person and one body, you see.
Right.
And I think that's very real. I mean, that's one of the reasons why I'm not really into this discourse about black bodies, black bodies, black bodies, black bodies. I don't mind people using the language, but we've never been just bodies. We have been very rich human beings, personalities grounded in relations to family, sometimes very ugly, sometimes very marvelous, usually ambiguous, but also communities. And it's that sense of our humanness and personalities who, of course, have bodies that we easily lose sight of, you
D.C.
Absolutely. And, you know, Beneatha in Raisin was, you know, had her own, you know, aspirations that were, she had her own greed in a way, right? Her own upward mobility fantasies, and her rage at Walter was partly about him choosing his aspirations over hers, both of which were twisted.
That's right.
And you know, like she's gonna be a doctor. She was like, not quite yet, honey. You gotta, you know, then and not to mention that's the not really where you should be putting your energy right now anyway. Everybody's hanging on by a thread.
Spend her money riding horses, and her mama's looking for food, and Ruth is looking for food with little Travis. You know, you say, well, yep, wait, and yet she's a brilliant sister off
exactly
to become a
right
doctor,
right
beautiful thing, you know,
right no I'm and that's my point. I'm not disparaging Beneatha. I'm really saying that you're absolutely right that when we internalize the language of objectification and containers, right, when we see ourselves as the containers structured by white fantasy or by colonial fantasy, then we lose sight of what Mama was really trying to do there, which was to say, look, we created this torn fabric of self-regard. We have to keep it together. There's no way anybody else is going to help us keep it together. This is where primary bonds and relationships do their most powerful work, because the public world is not going to do that for you. They're not going to take care when you're at your weakest and you're at your lowest and you want to basically metaphorically or literally just take the money regardless of what the consequences might be and what impact it might have on you, your family, and your community. And so she's really identifying this tattered fabric and saying, look, we have to hold it together. And to do it without a kind of recrimination. She's not attacking Walter. Nobody is. Beneath is the one who starts that attack. He's a rat. He's not a man. He's nothing but a rat. She goes straight to manhood, right? Again, as a weapon.
Right.
It's so hard to see that tattered fabric now because it looks like it's somehow the source of people's lack of freedom or the source of people's constraint.
God, that's so true. And the thing about Lorraine is, you know, you got the sign in Sidney Brustein's window where you don't have any black folk at all in that play. It's still a powerful play on what it means to be an intellectual in New York City, mainly a white bohemian intellectual, deeply Jewish intellectual that she was wrestling with. We got LeBlanc, which is very much a critique of African neocolonialism.
Mm-hmm.
You got What's the Use of Flowers. You know, she rewrites Waiting for Godot, you remember?
Oh, really? I didn't know that. Wow.
We call it The Arrival of Todol, which is Godot spelled backwards.
Oh, right.
And she goes right at Samuel Beckett, who's one of the greatest of the greatest. She goes right at Beckett. You got two gay brothers instead of Dodo and Go, Dee Dee and Go-Go, you see. And she actually, they began by playing the flute, which is very, very important. Because remember, Plato bans the flute in the Republic because the flute is the one instrument that gets people off beat. It generates a certain melody that makes you irrational and non-rational. Plato wants a rational person. She begins with the flute. She says, no, the music's going to be central, echo of the Black cultural tradition. You see, the music is going, what? That's where you're going to preserve your sanity and dignity and so forth. And she's imagining what the human race is like after the nuclear holocaust. And same is true in What Use of Flowers. So that's still the same Lorraine Hansberry.
That's right. That's right.
4 years old, gone with that kind of corpus, you know, and her best friend, Nina Simone.
34.
Nina Simone's daughter is her goddaughter. So she's got that kind of connection with the revolutionary movement, with Du Bois and company, with the artists.
And with Chicago, you know, Chicago political institutions, social institutions. I mean, they both share this love of Chicago.
Gwendolyn takes it to
Gwendolyn with Bronzeville,
With Bronzeville, and living so long since she dies in 2000.
Right. Staying in
right
the community.
Right there, Champlain with Haki and Dudley and all those other giants around her. Both of them, I think, will be dominant voices in the 21st century, even more so than they were in the 20th.
Yeah, I think we're going to see, I think you're absolutely right, Cornell. I think we're going to see a resurgence of Gwendolyn and her life as a model, along with Lorraine, the way we're seeing now with James Baldwin. Because the combination of a political fire and commitment that cannot be denied with an ethical core, a vision for this notion of a beloved community, the attempt to hold on to this fabric of self-love and community love and interpersonal justice, as I called it, where it's not just asking for justice from the state. It's concocting a kind of justice in our interpersonal relationships that serve as the basis for a community-focused effort against state repression. So it begins really on the interpersonal level. If we don't love ourselves right, we can't demand other people to love us right. We have to love ourselves right first. And that, all of that together, and then the love of the music and the culture, the faith in people's ability to survive, all of that makes them profound models for what we need right now. Right now.
That is so true. And with all of these vicious murders of our precious young Black brothers and sisters, people go home and just read the quatrain, the last quatrain, Emmett Till, by the great Gwendolyn Brooks.
Yes, that
8 lines, 4 sentences. And when she gets to that line where she says she kissed her dead son and she was sorry. We just had a long dialogue on this with the brothers, with Eddie and Mark and the two Chucks the other day. You know, what was she sorry about? What was Mamie Till, the great Mamie Till, who could stand up in front of the world and keep that casket open and say, I don't have a minute to hate. I will pursue justice for the rest of my life in Robert's Temple Church of God in Christ at the funeral of Emmett. What does she say I'm sorry for? That level of love, which is that notion of both in the personal justice that you're talking about, but that raw, visceral kind of love. At that point, we get real in Funksville, you see.
Yep.
That she's saying to herself, even given these vicious white supremacists down there in Money, Mississippi, I still feel that I'm sorry that I even put him in that situation.
Also, I mean, there's so many readings one could make of that. You know, no question she's sorry that she somehow put him in that situation, but she's also sorry that she couldn't protect him.
Yeah,
right?
I mean, that's exactly it. I'm sorry that he left Chicago. I never should have let him go down to the funeral. I'm sorry that I wasn't there with him all the time. I'm sorry that I couldn't protect him. That's exactly it. It's red. You know, it's the red. She's in a red room and her coffee is black.
Yeah.
Dignity all the way down.
Yeah.
Ooh.
Yeah. No, that, I mean, she's got clean clarity, no excess, no fluff, so simple, so to the point.
Straight chaser like monk.
No big words to try to make a point. You don't have to look up and get your
people.
Dictionary
She's
out.
Getting at the truth.
Right at the truth.
Mm-hmm. Right at she the and truth. Lorraine were like that. But
that's
all
true.
Of our great artists have been like that. Is it?
That's
I think
true.
one reason why Black woman's genius has been able to flower in the way that it has, and we've had Black male genius too, but too many of the Black brothers either convince themselves that they're really being embraced and respected and accepted by the white establishment. And therefore they start wearing the mask more often. Like Ralph Ellison, Ellison's genius is undeniable, but once he puts on the mask and wants to be part of the white establishment is over against the Black arts movement because somehow they are being trashed by the establishment and he is being accepted. And he's got his own legitimate critiques and he can have those critiques, but it's easier to seduce the Black brothers.
Mm-hmm.
I think
because
Black women coming more
from
the center of the culture.
You're absolutely right. But I think part of the reason that contributes to that risk that they have, that greater propensity to wear the mask, is that domesticity, instead of being a space for human beings living in intimate and social and family connections, becomes diminished and attached to femininity and womanhood. And so they're kind of displaced from the home, right? And in a quest to have a kind of public power. And to do that successfully, you got to put a mask on because you're not going to be able to have that kind of place where you come home to yourself in a safe way to talk about the pains and hurts and injuries of the world. That's one reason that I think it's harder. And the second reason is that there's probably nothing more threatening to a white supremacist, patriarchal society and world than an enraged, challenging Black man. And so the mask wearing is much more consistent in response to that.
I see what you're saying. I see what you're saying. I hadn't formulated it in that way. Because, you know, she has a, Lorraine Hansberry has a powerful unpublished essay on Simone de Beauvoir's Second Sex. She talks about one of the greatest books of the 20th century. But then she juxtaposes the men, especially the Black brothers, as hunters. She says one reason why the brothers like to hunt all the time, always be on viewing people as prey. It could be the women as prey. It could be going fishing and the fish as prey. But this whole sense of trying to dominate, all hunt down, subordinate, whereas the sexual division of labor in which patriarchy imposes itself, where the difficulty of being a hunter, the difficulty of getting that distance from the domestic space, you see, means then that you end up being much more at the center of a culture, and it's and the so the caring and nurturing of that culture lands more heavily on you.
That's right. Women's community has had to rely on everyone's giving of what they have, regardless of the public recognition. There's no external source that's going to give you anything for doing it. There's no external reward. So you're never interested in that because it was never what motivated the goals of the activity. And Gwendolyn Brooks was very much in that tradition. She, you know, understood, I've heard interviews with her daughter about her, you know, loving occasional finer things, but that those things were, you know, gravy, that the real bread and butter of her life was clean, clear, and fundamental, so that she was much less likely to get caught up in the kinds of bells and whistles and brass rings that are often presented. There was a funny interview on NPR I read in thinking about her for today, where she talked about when she won the Pulitzer, that her electricity had already been shut off. So when they called to say she had won, she knew the cameras were going to be showing up. And she said she knew they were going to plug them cameras in and wasn't going to turn on no doggone cameras because there wasn't no electricity. And so she was didn't sleep. Wow. Imagine that. She's winning the Pulitzer, the first African-American to win the Pulitzer. And her lights is off.
Her lights are off.
But it turns out somebody paid her electric bill. She did not know who paid it. Somebody knew she won it and they paid the bill so that she could be properly seen and represented in this victory. Now that's personal belief. I don't know who did it, but I guarantee you it was a sister.
Oh no, that's true. Probably with a little motivation from the Holy Ghost, from the community, the spirit of the community.
Oh, for sure. I am sure the whole community put that together.
We had a wonderful event just last year, opening the Gwendolyn Brooks Library at Chicago State University, led again by, you know, the great Hakeem Mahabute. But he was kind enough to bring me in. Sister Nora was there. The daughter was there as well. And all the stories that people told about Gwendolyn Brooks, the giving of herself, the nurturing of students, the caring for other poets, always affirming critically, because she had high standards.
Oh yeah, she didn't play.
Oh, she didn't play. Now she was old school in the best sense of that, because she knew she came from a great tradition of a great people. Yeah. But you can imagine what it would have been like if Lorraine had lived to be 80-something years old.
Oh, I mean, it would be.
She was born year before Toni Morrison was, 1930.
Oh my gosh! If she had just lived as long as Baldwin, I would have taken that.
Yeah.
You know, but, you know, we have so much from them, right? So we, I guess, you know, as much as I'd want more, I guess my note to myself is, look, Trisha, use wisely what you already have from these people, and you've not used it all. So when you're done really, you know, applying and nurturing and absorbing and sharing all that they've done, then go ahead and ask for some more, you know, ultimately.
That's a wise way of looking at it.
I mean, it also helps me to not feel so sad that she's gone. That's just my way of turning sadness into productivity.
Ooh-wee.
But well, this
when we lost Lorraine Hansberry, remember Malcolm X was at her funeral. Mm-hmm. Paul Robeson gave the eulogy. It was the last funeral Malcolm went to. We had lost Nat King Cole. We had lost Lorraine Hansberry. And then we would lose Malcolm. Mm-hmm. And when you think of those three who cast such a forever growing shadow on not just Black America, but on the country, we didn't even realize the hold that would be left in our culture, in our movement. Malcolm, Lorraine, and Nat King Cole. Early 1965. You know what I mean?
Right, right. And, you know, people often look to the firebrand intensity of the late 1960s for inspiration. But I think, you know, this earlier stage of geniuses and artists and political thinkers and spiritual thinkers really are very important and need more attention. I mean, there's no question. Nat King Cole, we weren't even planning to talk about him, but whoo, goodness gracious, underestimated. You know, and again, another kind of darling, right? Who had to be mute, doggone it. You have to watch him sing, you hear him sing some jazz, and you realize, oh, he was playing games on them pop songs. He was writing a, you know, writing a note to his mom while he was singing that. He wasn't actually doing any work yet.
He's one of the few that's near the orbit with Billie Holiday and Ella Fitzgerald,
sure,
and the greatest
for
of all,
sure,
Sarah Vaughan. But that is there. But then with Lorraine and Gwendolyn, that we're talking about at the same time,
right,
in that space,
in the same orbit, in the
giant,
same space.
Same,
you know, and
space.
I think that what's,
oh,
what's so.
No.
I mean, you know, what's really fascinating to me is, you know, how much genius can be beneath a performance that's misunderstood, right? That there's so much behind it that we don't have the venues, the opportunity, the market power or whatever it is to be seen doing. You know, if we somehow, that's what I thought the internet was going to do for us. Give us a venue. Like, imagine if Nat King Cole had the internet. What he would be able to play, sing, and do without having to do these other things. So it's that behind the scenes, and this, the misunderstanding produces a veil of its own that then makes it harder for us to see our own genius in the public world. So then we say, well, we don't want to be like Gwendolyn because she was the darling, and Lorraine Hansberry got misunderstood, so she must have done something wrong. Instead of saying, this is the way we get lost. This is the way we get distracted from what we have to offer, right? And how, you know, in the whole process.
It's true.
Yeah.
But they just had
here.
That sense of courage, vision, daring, willing to take a risk, building on the best of what came before them. And, you know, there are others as well, but those are two who take us to some of the highest heights. Of,
definitely.
Not just Black life, not just American life.
No,
all of human life.
I mean, Cornell, you know, we're just as universal as any other people's. Right. We're
that's,
not any more
exactly
specialized
right.
than any. We can teach the world a universal lesson about humanity just like anybody else. So these are stories that are not Black or universal. They're Black and universal.
That's right. That's exactly right. We got to keep that tradition alive. And it's still going.
It's going. It's just good to remember their gifts and to remember how important Chicago is. Chicago, you know, I'm a New Yorker, so I'm biased. But, you know, Andre, my husband, he's from the Midwest. So I got a lot of love for the Midwest.
Andre got Ohio coming.
Let's not even go into
that's
Ohio.
Right.
That's another story. OH10 in the house.
That's another story there. But I think in the end, though, with all the talk about identity, and we know identity is inescapable. No one person has one identity. We all have multiple identities. But in the end, the question is going to be, what is the real moral content of your identity?
Right.
What is the relation of your identity to integrity? What is the relation of the identity to courage? What is the relation of your identity to vision? How broad is your vision? Mm-hmm. Those are the fundamental questions about identity. So you don't get locked into the kind of narrow neoliberal modes, or don't get locked into the more deodorized corporate driven modes of talking about identity, because our identity is always, as you said, it's particular, universal, all the mediation between that, which means it's Black, it's gendered, it's regional, it's national, it's international, right, simultaneously.
Right. Yeah, and it's not perfect. And it's not ideal. It's got as many flaws and weaknesses as human beings all around the world do. But that doesn't mean we don't have something special to offer. It just means that we have something special and we're just as frail as everybody else.
That's right. That's exactly right.
And they both captured that. They captured
that. Oh, yeah. They remind us with their smile. You can just see both of them with their beautiful smiles. Gwendolyn Brooks smiles.
Oh, yes. Yes, indeed. Gwendolyn, Gwendolyn, she had a real old school strictness quality. Oh, about
you got a chance to meet her though, right?
I didn't get to meet her, but I wrote to her as a child. I wrote her a note when I was about 10 or 11 because I loved her poetry. So I wrote to thank her, you know, for it. And she wrote me back on my own note. So she sent my note back to me with her signature and, you know, thank you for writing to me. Good luck or something along those lines, Gwendolyn Brooks. And at first I thought, why'd she send my note back? Why didn't she keep it? Because I was 10. I didn't know, like, it would be more valuable for me to have my note with her note all on one piece of paper. I was like, why'd she send it back to me? She didn't want to keep it. And then over the years, I was like, oh, that was the kindest thing to do. But you know, when you're 10, what do you know? You don't know nothing. But I don't even know who told me to write to her. I don't have any idea how that happened. I got to ask my daddy.
When she was young, her mother, Keziah Corrine, used to tell her, you will be the Lady Paul Laurence Dunbar. And so she sent her poems to James Weldon Johnson when they came to Carter Temple Congregational Church, which was her church in Chicago, that James Weldon met her and had already sent a note back to her. Then when Langston Hughes came to the same church, she handed the poems to Langston. He stopped everything, read it on the spot and said, you're going to be a grand poet.
Wow.
14 years old, 15 years old. You see, her mother, who was a concert pianist, and her father, who was a brilliant organic intellectual, who's also a janitor, they knew that there was something so special in Gwendolyn Elizabeth. And that sense of her writing to you as a little girl with memories of her as a little girl writing to James Weldon Johnson and handing the poems to Langston Hughes. You see how that caravan
nice
of love
connection
that the Isley brothers talk about still
moving? Yeah, there's a caravan. Yeah, we definitely. Unfortunately, brother, I ain't got no poems in my back pocket to come close to none of them poems. So I'm going to try to hold it down. At least I'll sign every note that comes to me and I will send it back.
The potential of your genius and talent was already there. This little girl in the Bronx, born in Harlem, she's in the making.
All right. Well, I'll take it. I'll take it. I'm not going to let that go.
She must have known. But that's a beautiful
story. But you know what? I believe that it's not only what is true, but it's what we make true by what we believe in. Right.
So absolutely.
When young people are believed in, right, they go beyond their own talent ceiling.
That's exactly.
So, you know, had I had an inkling to write, I think I've written maybe two poems and I'll keep them to myself. Thank you. But, you know, that sense that someone thinks you can do something can actually help you transcend your wildest dreams. So we need to remember that it's not only about, well, she was a genius. She was also nurtured into her excellence, nurtured into her voice, given that access by faith and from others, which is interpersonal justice, which is what Mama was doing inside of the family to help people imagine and believe in themselves, despite what Mr. Lindsay was trying to say.
And in your essay on Lorraine Hansberry, there is a poetic prose at work. So you don't have to write verse to be poetic now.
Well, okay. Well, I'll take it coming from you. I'll take anything that complimentary, but you know, I don't know, brother.
No, absolutely.
I know not to argue with praise any further. I'll just simply say thank you.
I'll tell you the truth. But the beautiful thing is that transgenerational tradition of struggle and love that we see on the stage in Raising in the Sun, that you see in the corpus of Gwendolyn Brooks, that what the tightrope as a show is all about.
You can't be on that tightrope. Speak on that, bro. You're absolutely. Say some more on that. That is so true.
No, you got that. What we told the great one and only Sonny Rollins, and he understood exactly that when you hear Sonny blowing, You can hear Coleman Hawkins. You can hear Lester Young. You can hear Coltrane. You can hear Ben Webster. You can hear all of those folk that he studied very closely. You can hear Mary Lou Williams' piano. It doesn't have to be the same instrument. And the same is true for us, you see.
That
we listen to you. We read your poetic prose. We look at your witness. We know that comes from mama, daddy, community, heritage, history, shot through you. We were talking about Stokely, a mint condition. Right. That his impact on my life, his impact on your life, he's inside of us.
That's right. That's right. And we in the tightrope are not just here to have fancy, famous conversations. We're here to do exactly that, to bring and bridge generations, to have conversations about, you know, what's going to nurture us, what's going to keep us alive. I mean, we can technically survive this pandemic and survive this onslaught of killing, you know, African-American people. But are we going to survive with what we need to plant the seeds for tomorrow, the one that we want tomorrow, not the tomorrow other people are planting for us? So that's what we're in the business of on this show, in my opinion, you know?
That's exactly right. No, you stated that's what our calling is.
Yeah.
That's what our calling
and
is.
And that's what many people write to us and say, you know, I mean, just to let y'all know out there, you know, we hear you and we appreciate when you say,
we do appreciate
you. You know, we so appreciate when you say whatever you say, but especially when you say, you know, this was the word I needed today. I feel uplifted. Thank you for talking to Sonny Rollins. He really brought out, you know, some joy when there's so little right now. You know, we're not just here to make people feel good in the feel good shallow sense. We're here to try to create and to remind ourselves. Really, it helps us. I mean, it helps me to be here in conversation with you. I'd be like, dang, is it time to tape yet? I need to talk to Brother West.
Absolutely. It enriches my heart, mind, soul. Absolutely. And at the deepest level. And even our own group itself, though, you know what, our dear brother Jeremy and brother Sister Allie and Sister Evan and Brother Dwayne. I mean, it really is a team at that deepest level of all of us trying to be true to this calling in our distinctive ways. And it's a beautiful thing. And we find joy in it. We have a good time, just like Gwendolyn did, just like Lorraine did.
Yep. And don't forget Bootsy.
Oh, Lord have mercy.
Bootsy had a good... Bootsy was out. That was a funk party. He brought out the spirit. That was funk church.
Lord, I'm telling you.
He's a beautiful... I mean, that all that beautiful spirit that all we need that to beauty. Bottle up and share beauty, all over.
That's so true. So I want to salute you as I salute Lorraine and Gwendolyn. I tell you that.
We all salute you so much, Cornell. I just adore you. And I can't believe how much you're able to just pull information. I don't know where it comes from. I ask you questions just so I can marvel at what you're going to say and the level of detail you're about to drop. I'm like, so Cornell, what about fill in the blank? Then I'm just, let me sit right on back. Get me some popcorn up in here. And I'm going to watch this thing unfold. It's much better than TV, let me tell you.
We blowing our instruments and singing our songs.
Singing our song. You got your tuba today. I know that.
I got my tuba too.
Man, well, this was so lovely. I'm so happy we had some time to just sit and reflect. You know, I know we normally have guests, but every once in a while we just treat each other like a guest. And you know, like our Purple Rain episode, you know, if you haven't seen that one, you should check it out because Doc has some fantastic information about
Brother Prince.
We just wanted to celebrate two sisters we know are geniuses. So we're going to have to sign off now, Cornell, and wish everyone a wonderful day and ask them to please join us. Where should they join us, Doc?
On the tightrope.
Yes, on the tightrope.
And Brother West having a good time.
Yes, indeed. All right, everybody. Thanks for joining us.